It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a law firm representing conservative interests, filed a complaint with the Federal Office for Civil Rights alleging that the Green Bay Area Public School District discriminated against a student on the basis of race. That student is white.
The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights is conducting similar investigations in other states, including Illinois and New York.
In Green Bay, the case centers on a parent who says her dyslexic son was denied reading resources because of a plan at King Elementary School that prioritized students of color.
Ian Main is an associate professor at the UW Law School, where he teaches in the areas of civil rights and race in the law. Ian, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Kate.
Can you speak to the contours of this complaint and what it is alleging?
Sure. As background mentioned by Rob, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, has looked for opportunities around the nation to cancel DEI programming. To that end, we have the complaint that was filed by WILL with the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. And in doing so, WILL has set up a false dilemma here. WILL is arguing that the district's policy that addresses racial discrimination, there's racial disparities in Green Bay in educational outcomes, as there are in every district in the state of Wisconsin. So the district set up a program to provide an assistance to students of color in order to close that gap. And so WILL is arguing that that policy must be ended if a child with dyslexia is to get appropriate care under a separate policy, which is the federal policy, which is the Individuals with Disability Education Act, the IDEA. And many of your listeners have heard of an IEP, an Individualized Education Plan, mm-hmm. or program.
Yep.
And that comes from this act, the IDEA Act, or the Individuals with Disability Education Act. And this student and their parents have rights under the IDEA. And it sounds like, from the allegations that I've read anyway, that the student has been, you know, given, and the parents have been given the runaround. They had a much better experience in their prior school or district, and they're having a terrible experience getting the programming and support they need for their child here in this particular elementary school. And I certainly, in my experience, I have seen, you know, different treatment of students with the same IEP plan from one school going to another, right? And so districts need to obviously make sure that their schools are providing the services that are required under the IDEA. And so these two policies, the district policy that is basically intended to close the racial disparities that are occurring in the district, and the IDEA, both serve very different and important goals. And the IDEA provides particularized services to students with disabilities. Dyslexia is covered by the IDEA, and the students should be getting services under the IDEA, and that's where this complaint should be focused. The students or the parents here, if the district doesn't comply, can go to state or federal court, and they would be able to bring a lawsuit saying, look, the district is not giving the services provided. The school could not, for example, say, well, we can't give the student the appropriate care under the IDEA because we have this DEI program. That would not be appropriate. Mm. That would fail in any state or federal court under an IDEA defense, if that makes sense. But this DEI program is completely separate and, as a legal matter, just not logically connected. But again, WILL is looking for opportunities around the country to cancel DEI programming. And this is just part of what it does. And here it has a fairly sympathetic and important case regarding disability rights that, as I see it, just does not have a logical connection to the programming that the Green Bay has implemented to close its, what I imagine is a significant disparity regarding racial disparity regarding educational outcomes.
I want to pick up on what you said there around the country, because the Office for Civil Rights is filing complaints of racial discrimination at schools in other parts of the country. Cases, Virginia, Chicago, there's New York, you know, all claiming that white students are being discriminated against because of policies designed to help racial minorities. Do you see a pattern here?
There is a pattern. The pattern's been going on for 400 years. I mean, but if we look at this just from a 1,000 point of view, just notice that all the complainants are white, despite the fact that we have shocking racial disparities in every single sphere of measurement, whether it's housing, economics, education, jobs, health. It goes on and on. And we have shocking disparities and active discrimination, both caused by historical and by just current practices that are affecting communities of color. And the fact that these cases are brought by white kids should be a red flag for anyone thinking about race, because white people have been beneficiaries of racism. And racial, oppression is structural, and it harms people of color and it benefits white people. The view of the advocates at Will and unfortunately the majority of the Supreme Court looks at race as something that just can occur. Any decision based on someone's skin color is racism. And that's kind of the colorblind view of racism, and one that erases the act of racial harm that is occurring every day against racial groups. And so if, as a professor at the University of Wisconsin, when I look at my students, I had 60 students in my first class this last year, and one student was a Black student out of 60. It's just shocking the disparities that we have. And, when we look at how many Black students are enrolled undergraduate in the incoming class of UW, it's about 2.4%.
Wow.
Despite, a national kind of demographic of 13%. And it's these kind of programs that Green Bay is trying to work early, right? To close that education gap, to give that opportunity, and to bring that from 2% to closer to 13%, say, as incoming students at UW, which would be the fair outcome.
Ian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ian Main, associate professor at the UW Law School. We turn now to Lauren Groyle, who is an associate counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. This is the firm that brought the complaint against the Green Bay Area Public School District. Lauren, welcome.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Can you talk about, is this complaint centered on violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or is this about racial discrimination?
So both. That is the short answer. The Trump administration finished reviewing our complaint and determined that there was enough material in the complaint to warrant an investigation into the district, specifically on whether the district violated Title VI, which is racial discrimination, and whether the district failed to evaluate the student as a student with disabilities who is believed to need special education or related services to be consistent. And they are absolutely two connected things here, because the district is allocating resources for literacy supports and resources based on race, not based on need. So this child was put on a waiting list because of his race, because he wasn't the correct race, as opposed to because he didn't need as many services as other students in the district. So both race and disability law are at issue here.
And so in this complaint, it's what is called the student success plan that was set by King Elementary School. The school has since changed the language in the plan. Do you think those are steps toward what you're looking for?
Obviously, the district is taking steps now in the right direction. It's a little bit too late at this point because this student has already been harmed. And Title VI complaints can be retroactive, not prospective like a lot of lawsuits are. But even though they changed some of the language, they still list these priority performance groups by race. Instead of explicitly saying that they'll prioritize those by race now, they say they'll prioritize students who need the help. But that begs the question, why create the priority performance groups if you're not going to prioritize race at all? So it's a good step. We're happy to see that the district is taking this seriously, but it's certainly not enough. And it doesn't change the fact that this student went over a year without the supports that he was entitled to.
Lauren, do you think schools should be able to prioritize certain groups that have historically had much less access to resources?
That's a great question. I will say I'm very sympathetic to the fact that we're trying to be cognizant of past historical wrongs here, but having a benevolent reason to be racist doesn't make it okay. And that's what's happening here. Title VI prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin in any program receiving federal financial assistance against any race. By prioritizing students of specific races for additional resources, the district excludes other students, like Mrs. Decker's son, from equal access to educational resources. It could be for a benevolent reason, like has been discussed, to uplift certain marginalized communities, but it's still illegal and it's still racial discrimination. It just was the anniversary this past May, the 71st anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. And we should be well past the time that we are considering race. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, we should be evaluating these students on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. This district needs to be evaluating these students on the basis of their needs rather than the color of their skin.
And as we wrap up here, what are the next steps in this for Will?
Yeah, so we'll be monitoring now. The Trump administration is going to open an investigation into the school district. So that means that they're going to look into all the allegations in our complaint. We'll be available to provide any additional resources and work with our client, Mrs. Decker, and her son as they conduct interviews, among other things. But we are hopeful that the district will continue to make changes, whether it be mandated by the Department of Education or on their own, because every student deserves an opportunity to learn to the best of their ability, regardless of the color of their skin.
Lauren, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Lauren Groyle, Associate Counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, that brought the complaint earlier. We heard from Ian Main, Associate Professor at the UW Law School.
Coming up, a UW-Madison Health Project teams up with providers in rural areas to provide trainings for EMS care for kids and more.
Training that this will be providing will give us more confidence and a better overall patient care ultimately.
Find out more next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About a quarter of Wisconsin's population lives in rural areas, and it can be a challenge for healthcare providers to find training and support for services.
Residents in rural parts of the state can face worse mental and physical health outcomes than other regions, in part because of disparities in healthcare access.
This week, the UW School of Medicine and Public Health launched the Orion Initiative. It's a program aimed at expanding training access to EMS services and healthcare providers in rural areas. That includes a partnership with EMT services in Green Lake County in central Wisconsin.
Evan Vanden Langenberg is the chief of Berlin Emergency Medical Services in Green Lake County, and Dr. Amy Kine is associate dean for social health sciences and programs at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and CEO of this Orion Initiative. Dr. Kine, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here.
And Evan, thanks for being with us.
I'm very excited.
Before we get to this new partnership, Evan, I want to meet your EMS team there in Berlin. Talk about maybe some of the challenges you face as a EMS team in a rural area over the last handful of years.
So Berlin EMS has three full-time ambulances in the north side of Green Lake County. All three of our stations are located in the three big cities in the north side of Green Lake County. It would be Berlin, City of Green Lake, and the City of Princeton. We have a roster of about 18 full-time employees with some mixed in volunteer employees that also help us out during times of need. We are a small community. The county of Green Lake has about 20,000 people in it, and we cover about 14,000 people of that on the north side of the county. So the struggles that we have really comes down to is finding good training, finding people who will come out to kind of the middle of nowhere and meet with us and be at our trainings. And then also, it also comes down to funding as well. Being rural with a limited tax base and taxpayers kind of picking up the majority of our budget, let alone with some billing, it all comes back to having money to be able to provide good training and good training materials, which can be tough with our little budget and yet such a broad area of people.
Dr. Kine, that's where the Orion Initiative is coming in. You're focusing here on pediatric training for the Green Lake County EMS teams. Can you give us a little bit about the partnership and why you're focusing on this specialty?
Yes, absolutely. The Orion Initiative is a new initiative based at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health that believes in strong transformative powers of partnership with groups like the Green Lake EMS group that we're talking to today. And our goal is to bring those rural providers together with our academic medical community to ultimately improve health in rural communities across the state. We are starting with areas like pediatric emergency care because we've seen a great need when we've talked to our frontline rural providers all over Wisconsin. The ability for us to come together to create tailored solutions that are designed for rural health needs for people in rural areas and providers who are caring for them is something that's been a big gap in opportunities around training. And we're excited to partner with all sorts of groups across the state in order to innovate in this area and to really address some of these challenging rural health issues that are going forward.
Evan, I think about rural EMS. Basically, your job is only everything, right? You have to be prepared for this huge variety of emergencies. How hard is it to get that particular training for something like pediatric, where, as you say, it may not be your top call volume, but when that call comes in, it's serious?
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. And that's, you know, what we're really looking forward to with this type of funding and this type of partnership is to be able to have that really good hands-on training, which for paramedics and EMTs alike, hands-on for us is such a big deal. It imprints it into our minds so much better than just, you know, doing an online training course, which is what we have been doing because we're so rural and to be able to get people up here, that was kind of our only option. So with this opportunity to do more hands-on training with more lifelike mannequins and training equipment is going to open up a lot of doors for us.
Dr. Kine, can you talk us through the process of designing this training and working with Green Lake County here? What's the process to make sure they're getting the most out of this experience?
Yes, that's a great question. Well, when we can work with the chief, Evan, and his team, what we're able to do is to re-examine the traditional approaches to training and really flip those on their head, innovate them in a way that continues to result in the best trained workforce possible, but in a way that works for our rural frontline providers. You know, as we started this program, our team spent a long time talking to frontline rural providers across the state. And what we heard is that, wow, there's this huge need for training, but the trainings that were available were not meeting the rural needs. They, as Evan said, they were predominantly online. They did not build connections, human connections, and often some of the advanced equipment that was required in order to really help improve health wasn't there. So when we think about pediatric emergency care, we hear about EMS groups across the state and rural areas that are trained to take care of adults, but not kids. So when you encounter, if you're an EMS professional and you encountered a hurt child there in a rural area, whatever might have happened, suddenly you are often out of your comfort zone. So the ability to take high quality expert physicians at the University of Wisconsin Department of Emergency Medicine, these are pediatric trained specialists, and bring them to Evan and his team in Green Lake using the cutting edge simulation training technology, other high opportunity educational techniques, is something that we haven't had before within rural Wisconsin. And we're learning from the Green Lake team. We're learning from Evan. We're learning what works, what doesn't work from their team. And we'll be able to then bring that in into these novel models that then can go well beyond Green Lake County and hopefully stretch the other corners of Wisconsin.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about next, Dr. Kind. The idea here isn't just we've worked with Green Lake County and we're done. It's we're taking lessons, right, from Green Lake County and saying, okay, now how do we replicate the successes here in rural communities around the state?
That's exactly right. And every lesson we learn from those frontline rural providers goes into our training. We learn things about the tempos of the training or the content, the areas in particular that they see as areas of need. And when we offer this co-design, this training that's made for rural providers by rural providers in partnership with university academic physicians, it allows us to really create something new. Certainly, I myself am from a rural area. I've seen the challenges that are the people in my hometown in northern rural Wisconsin face. And often the care that's delivered is a challenge. There's not enough of almost anything. And so this ability to help individuals who are at the front line in rural areas to build their capacity in a whole host of targeted ways that works for them is something that's a big passion of mine.
Evan, something I'm thinking about here is a lot of times in our lives, our work lives, when we do trainings, you know, somebody designs the training for us. We take what they give us and like it, I guess. In this case, you have your hand in it. You're helping design the thing and then helping figure out how it can be used elsewhere. What does that mean to you to be part of this process of the training that you and your team are going to get?
I think that's honestly what my team is really excited about, is kind of making this tailored exactly to what we're looking for and what we've been lacking in, to really bring out people's confidence levels to be able to go, yeah, I really don't know how to do this very well, and I would like to learn how to do it correctly, properly, and safely for both us and the patient. So I think that's what's really getting my team energized, is that this isn't already a set in schedule kind of training event. It's really going to be tailored to what we've seen out in the field and what we would like to learn and how we would look to do better for those types of events.
We're talking about a new effort to expand rural healthcare training. Evan Vanden Langenberg is with us from Berlin Emergency Services, Dr. Amy Kind with the Orion Initiative. Dr. Kind, this is just one of three sort of pilot programs, if that's the right word. What are the other things you have going on in Wisconsin as you kick things off?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, let me say that all of the programs that go forward take the same approach, in which we are creating these true partnerships with frontline rural providers to not only help understand what content is most needed, but to tailor training specifically for the rural experience, to build capacity in a lot of different ways. So in addition to the EMS providers in Green Lake that are helping in this partnership to design pediatric emergency care services, we are also working with Richland Hospitals and Clinics to bring specialty training in rheumatology, joint diseases, and inflammatory diseases, and to build capacity there. We're also strengthening rural physician recruitment at Gunderson Moundview Hospitals and Clinics, and really trying to think about innovative ways to partner with Gunderson and to address some of the biggest challenges that they've had in recruiting physicians to serve their populations. And then beyond that, that, we are thinking also about the future physician workforce. The Orion Initiative is funding scholarships for students who are taking part in the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. This is a program that trains students to be the next generation of rural physicians for Wisconsin. So we are really excited. We are a young program. We are energized. We are excited to partner in a way that the rural sites, that rural communities really, really need, and to rethink these approaches to capacity building and recruitment in completely innovative ways with help with individuals like Evan and his team in Green Lake County.
Dr. Kine, staying with you for a moment, I've had conversations about with people in rural healthcare. Can we keep our doors open at this hospital or clinic? Can we keep our maternity ward open? Is there mental health or addiction treatment within a 100-mile radius of our location, that kind of thing? How big are the needs you're hearing about as you talk to these communities, the ones you're partnering with or others?
Oh, the needs are huge. Our rural communities within Wisconsin and elsewhere have great, great challenges at their doorstep. And some of these challenges continue to grow. We know that people in rural communities experience diseases at disproportionate rates. They're much sicker often, especially with heart disease and stroke, than other individuals who live outside of rural areas. When we think about individuals who serve rural areas, they typically are hard to recruit. The people who are there are very, very dedicated. But often access to specialty and subspecialty care is extremely limited. So the idea that you need to wait to see a specialist or travel sometimes 4 hours or more to get the care that you need in order to take care of your condition is an increasing reality as hospitals close or as portions of hospitals close. So through the Orion Initiative, by helping with recruitment and by thinking about this targeted capacity building in a way that rural providers really need, that they find useful and is targeted specifically to thinking about their needs and their requirements for support, is something that we're hoping to do. The other piece about delivering care in a rural setting is it can be somewhat isolating. When I was visiting sites across Wisconsin, the most common thing that I would hear, besides this issue of hospitals closing and access being a challenge, is that it could be an isolating experience, the experience of being on the front line in a rural community and ultimately having to serve an entire variety of health conditions within a population. So we want to be there for our rural providers. And by matching them with University of Wisconsin School of Medicine specialists and other medical academic providers, we hopefully can not only build capacity in the rural area, but provide some human-to-human contact that decreases isolation and makes the practice of medicine a little less lonely.
Well, Evan, that gives me a lot of questions I want to ask you. Now, first of all, do you and your team have that sense of isolation in some ways? You know, we're out here on our own providing care to our region.
Yeah, I mean, when you really think about people who come out this way, I think a lot of it doesn't go through their heads that, you know, our local community hospital is a small hospital. It doesn't have all that specialty care. It really is a critical access point to get you into that. And then those people normally either have to go on, or sometimes we have to bypass that hospital and we have to travel to the bigger cities to get those people to the definitive care that they need, to get them to see the specialists that they need. So it does come back down to feeling kind of isolated. And you know, when you're going through cornfields and marshes and things like that, even though we have a local hospital in this county, we can still be 45 minutes to an hour away, depending on the part of the county that you're in. So it's not like a big city where you can be at a hospital, multiple hospitals in a couple of big cities in a matter of minutes. We can take upwards to, you know, half hour to an hour to get you to at least a critical access point. So isolation is definitely a feeling that the crews feel sometimes.
Evan, I wanted to ask about staffing when I talk to rural departments. I've heard a mix of stories, some all-volunteer places struggling, some actually doing pretty well with recruitment. You're a hybrid situation there, staff and volunteers. Do you have the person power you need?
Right now, we have actually only went full-time about 6 years ago. So 6 years ago, we were a medic service with only three full-time paramedics, and the rest of us were all volunteer. And we were really starting to struggle as schooling is getting tougher and longer hours for what the state demands. It really has been cutting down on the ability to volunteer this type of work. So the people going through the school at this point in time are really looking to create this as a career for them. And in order to do that, we went back to our citizens about 6 years ago through the county, and they had unanimous support for us to go full time and pick up that bill, which is not a small bill to be able to staff 18 full-time employees to be able to do this. But with the community support that we do have in Green Lake County, which is amazing, and then now for this to open up that door into this project with the Orion Group is just been really mind-blowing in my experience. And my time working here, I've never envisioned being able to get this far with what we were at to where we are now is amazing to me.
Dr. Kind, as we wrap up, this is early days for the Orion Initiative and these partnerships. Look ahead, say a year or so. What does success look like?
Oh, that's a great question, Rob. Well, we would like to take what we're learning from Evan and others and then test them in a second round, what we're calling a beta phase of tests of additional sites within Wisconsin to learn more and then spread statewide. The goal here is to design programs that ultimately will reach all corners of Wisconsin. You know, with the School of Medicine and Public Health, we are a school of our state. We are a school for the state, and we want to serve the state. And so this opportunity to reach into rural contexts, to partner with Green Lake County and others to help teach us how best to do that is something that we are really excited for. So we have a lot of learning to go. We have a lot of journey yet to take, but our goal is to reach all of Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Kind, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
And Evan, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you for having me join.
Evan Vanden Langenberg is Chief of Berlin Emergency Medical Services. Dr. Amy Kind is with UW School of Medicine and Public Health and CEO of the Orion Initiative. We've been talking about this new partnership that'll boost training for rural healthcare providers.
Up on Wisconsin Today, a new partnership between the Washera Gardeners Club and the local food pantry gets fresh produce to neighbors who are hungry.
The two just mesh perfectly together as a way of supporting the people in our community that are food insecure.
The Plant a Row program in Washera County, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 30 years ago, the National Plant a Row for the Hungry campaign inspired people to grow fresh produce to support their neighbors who face food insecurity.
And decades later, gardening clubs and food pantries across Wisconsin still encourage anyone with a garden to plant an extra row of produce and donate their harvest.
In central Wisconsin, the Washera County Food Pantry receives more than 2,000 pounds in fresh donations from local farmers and gardeners.
Volunteers hope to surpass that goal this season with help from the Plant a Row for the Hungry initiative.
We're learning about the partnership food pantries have with local garden clubs. Kathy Shaw is president of the Washera Gardeners Club, and Susan Herman is a volunteer with the Washera County Food Pantry in Wautoma. Kathy and Susan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's great to be here.
Thank you very much.
Susan, let's start with you. Can you talk about the work you're doing at the pantry, especially with fresh produce?
We have donations from various stores around the area. We also have donations from people in the area that have gardens, and then they bring in their produce to the pantry. We also have a garden that we're just starting up at the pantry to grow more produce fresh for use at the pantry.
What kind of produce is coming in?
Potatoes, cucumbers. We will get corn and tomatoes, squash, onions, just a huge variety of donations.
And how do you go about getting it distributed? Are you moving it around, this produce?
Right at our food pantry, they get separated out, and then there are guidelines for how many of each different category one of our clients will get. So let's say they'll get 3 vegetables and 2 fruits and a package of garlic, mm-hmm. for example. So then they all get boxed up so that when clients come through, they're all ready to receive their produce, and then they'll get other things like bread and meat and so on.
Kathy, turning to you, you're a passionate gardener. We're in the prime growing season. What's in the garden this year to eat as well as donate?
We grow pretty much all of the vegetables that we eat. So it's more like what don't we grow, which is corn, because it takes up too much room in the garden. So we'll go out and pick purchase a couple of dozen ears a year, and that's good enough for us. So I am planning on donating beans for sure. We have a lot of green beans and apples and pears off of our trees. And then we will grow like broccoli. And if we have more than what the gallon of that we will freeze plus what we eat fresh, that would go to the pantry as well. So we kind of do it by knowing how much we're going to need for ourselves to keep for the year. And then we donate any excess.
Wow, I'm still stuck on the pear trees. Can you talk a little bit about the orchard?
We have 2 pear trees and 7 apple trees. And so it's just my husband and I, so it's way more than we can normally eat or even drink as juice or have applesauce or pear sauce and things like that. So again, once we've got everything that we need to put up for the year all taken care of, the rest of it goes to the food pantry.
And Kathy, I understand this is the first year the Washera Gardeners Club is partnering with the food pantry. How did this relationship develop?
Well, it was kind of an accident almost. We were supposed to have the Wisconsin Honey Queen. We were hoping to have her in January for our speaker at our regular January meeting. And a couple weeks before then, we found out she wasn't going to be able to. So we had tapped the food pantry to see if someone could come and speak from their organization. And Mary Kunesh, who's on the board of directors, came and spoke to us that night. And that's what started the whole dialogue about it.
What was the takeaway? What struck you as thinking this is something we really need to do?
It was Tyler from the food pantry came back to us probably in February, or maybe it was early March, and said, what can we do this? And we were going to be having another meeting. And so he came before our seed sharing. We were doing a prep for another meeting, and he came and spoke to about 12 of us. And that's when everybody got really excited about it. He did, and our whole group did, and said, what can we do to get this going?
Susan, what do you think about this partnership and what might come of it?
I think it's an excellent opportunity. My husband and I volunteer at the Washera Food Pantry, and I'm Washera Gardener, so it's like the two just mesh perfectly together as a way of supporting the people in our community that are food insecure. And we've got outlets to make people aware that this is something that they can do with their own home gardens, is bring in fresh produce that they have extras of.
You really think it'll catch on?
I'm certain of it.
You know, we've heard a little bit of some of the items that Kathy has just mentioned growing in her garden, including the pears. What items are the most popular at the food pantry? What do people seek out?
I think any of the fresh fruit and vegetables. People like things that are easy to make and you can eat fresh vegetables without any preparation, fresh fruit, you know, straight from the tree. So it makes for good and healthy eating, easy prep. So it's just the perfect time to take advantage of it for our short growing season here in Wisconsin.
Short growing season, and in a pantry situation, I mean, these products aren't like your typical peanut butter that can sit on a shelf for a while. So how do you ensure that the pantry can get this fresh produce out the door and to the people who need it so that it doesn't spoil?
Right. We do have to be very careful of that. The produce is all prepped and put into amounts for each client that day, that morning, as it's getting ready to go out the door. So any fruit that's not, or vegetables that is not fresh and in good condition gets put aside, and then that gets composted.
I'm curious, in these boxes that you put together for the clients, are there recipes included?
No, there are not. That would be, you know, something that seems like a great idea. What we find with our clients is often they don't have all the other ingredients to make up a meal. For example, a box of macaroni and cheese seems very quick and easy meal to put together, but the client may not have milk or the client may not have butter. So that's where I think fruits and vegetables are such wonderful things to be supplying, not only for the health benefits, but for the ease of preparation and consuming them.
We're talking about the Plant a Row for the Hungry campaign, this national effort to get people to donate part of their garden harvest. And we have Susan Herman there of the Washera County Food Pantry talking about their partnership with Fresh Produce. Kathy Shaw of the Washera Gardeners Club working on this effort. Susan, Feeding America estimates that more than 600,000 people are food insecure in Wisconsin. And thinking about ways to address hunger, more garden clubs and food pantries are starting to work together. What have you learned as far as food insecurity from the perspective of Washera County Food Pantry?
Well, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about people who need food. The people that we see coming through are good, hardworking people, and they're trying their best, but sometimes it's just too hard to make ends meet, and sometimes something suddenly happens to a family. One of the breadwinners is injured and unable to work, or, you know, some other kind of serious thing that happens that makes people who otherwise are able to supply their family with food suddenly in need of support. And so what I really learned is that there are a lot of stories to be told out there, and that we shouldn't be making judgments about people who need help. We should be out there helping them to get the food they need.
Kathy, I would imagine you spend a lot of time in the garden, a lot of time, growing all the produce. And do you think about those end goals as to who might be eating what you are harvesting?
I think it's great that we have an outlet that is going to help someone else that is food insecure, that any excess produce isn't going to just rot because we don't have time to harvest it or get it over to the food pantry. So that's what's neat about our partnership with them, is getting that word out of when is a good time to drop it off at the pantry, making sure that when we're dropping it off, it's right now fresh, ready to go for them.
And Susan, in April, we spoke with Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin about the Trump administration cutting a pair of hunger relief programs that had been run by the USDA. And we talked with Matt Steenstra at the time about the impact of funding reductions on food banks. Let's take a listen.
The increase in hunger has started really back in 2023. And what we've seen is a 30% increase in demand at our food pantries across all 370 partners that we see in our 35 counties. The increase in childhood hunger, we're in the middle of the greatest spike of childhood hunger since the Great Recession.
Is Washera County experiencing this kind of spike? It is particularly in childhood hunger.
I know that number of families that come through looking for support with food is It's staggering for the small number of people in our Washira County. And there's a real need. And cutting the funding for it is not going to make America great again. We need to be supporting people and helping people to find a way to make their life sustainable and pleasant and have children grow up with full bellies so that they could become the best possible citizens that they can.
The Washira County Food Pantry receives thousands of pounds in fresh donations. Are there new goals for this particular growing season, considering the hunger initiative going on?
I just know that we're going to do our best as Washira gardeners to get the word out and keep that food coming in so that the food is put to good use, the best use possible, not rotting on the vines like Kathy suggested.
And Susan, you recently opened a demonstration garden on the food pantry grounds. Can you walk us through it and what this project is about?
Well, we just started it. It came up as an idea with the director for the food pantry, and there's a small area that wasn't being used, and so we covered it over with cardboard to eliminate the grass and covered it with mulch and purchased some raised beds that we got filled, and we're getting it planted now. So this will be our kickoff here and to really discover what kinds of things can we grow the most effectively in a small space to help supply the food pantry. But we're also hoping beyond that, that we can show people that perhaps they too could grow some food on their own. And we're hoping to show that there are ways to do it without a great deal of expense, using things that you might have available without having to go out and purchase lots of supplies in order to be able to grow a garden on your own.
Will there need to be more volunteers to keep this demonstration garden going?
Well, I think that we've found there are three of us from the Share Gardeners that are working on it, but we'll also have people that volunteer at the food pantry that can come out and help with, you know, a little weeding and some watering, which is mostly what we need to do to keep it up. And I think that'll be very manageable.
That sounds really exciting. And I wonder, Kathy, do you think that's kind of the next step here in order to continue to spread the love of gardening and just the impact it can make?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's so much more that we can do there. There is actually been a little bit of talk that perhaps in the future that there might even be room at another area behind the food pantry where they might be even able to start up a community garden. So, you know, depending on how this goes, you know, seriously, the sky's the limit.
Well, Kathy and Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Oh, you're welcome.
That is Kathy Shaw of the Washira Gardeners Club and Susan Herman of the Washira County Food Pantry. They were talking about the Plant a Row for the Hungry campaign, encouraging gardeners to donate a portion of their harvest to help feed people in the community in need of fresh food.
Here's a bit of news to Wisconsin up your email inbox. WPR has relaunched our Wisconsin Today daily newsletter.
So each weekday, our colleague in the newsroom, newsletter editor Jenny Peek, is curating for you the day's top stories from around the state, incredible audio segments to check out, feature photos from WPR's photojournalist Angela Major, and here's the thing, you'll find behind-the-scenes conversations with our reporters and producers about how we discover, report, and deliver trustworthy news.
There will also be opportunities for you to provide feedback and weigh in polls.
You can sign up at wpr.org/newsletters. Stay informed and connected. That's the Wisconsin Today daily newsletter to your inbox. Subscribe at wpr.org/newsletters. Lace up your hiking boots, grab the binoculars, because admission is free at state parks, forests, and trails this weekend.
The DNR's 13th annual Free Fun Weekend is almost here, and the DNR says this year's event marks the 125th anniversary of the Wisconsin State Park System.
And by the numbers, that system is home to 50 state parks, 15 state forests, and 44 state trails.
And that trail leads us to you. What is your favorite state park in Wisconsin and why? What do you love to do there? What's your favorite memory enjoying the natural beauty of our state?
Maybe you revisit a certain place in Wisconsin every year. Share your state park traditions. Give a shout out to your favorite park.
You can do that. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Colleen Leahy, Royce Padeswa, and Courtney Everett. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.